Welcome, welcome to Black Ink Cinema Podcast, the powerhouse, Dr. Samina Fumbo, aka Mina, the founder and managing director of Black Girl Convention and co-founder of Black Wave Productions.
Good Hello. Afternoon, morning, evening.
First of all, I just want to say, hair, fabulous.
Oh, thank you.
Got hair for it. Absolutely amazing. Honestly, very privileged to have you. I fully enjoyed your documentary. And of course, Black Ink Cinema is all about celebrating Black cinema. So I was excited to have the chance to speak with an executive coach, experienced mentor, and diversity and inclusion consultant delivering to clients across the USA, Europe, and Asia. We're here to discuss your documentary, Some Girls Hate Dresses. As you are the maker, please tell us a little bit about the film.
Yeah, I guess, Some Girls Hate Dresses is just kind of was born out of my last film, actually, which is called The Glorious Ones, which was looking at an intergenerational conversation between queer, non-binary, black and non-binary women, black, African, Caribbean heritage, or the diaspora, however people identify. And the idea was to talk to people from sort of in their 20s through to their 70s. And what I found was through talking to contributors, people sort of age 40 and above, unless your family sort of took photographs of you or videos of you, they didn't have an archive. So it really got me thinking about where are the images that represent us from that time? And when you sort of, Google or look for images or archive of black women or tomboys, I guess you might say, was what we called ourselves back then from that demographic, pre-social media, pre sort of the internet, there's a very limited archive because mainstream broadcasters weren't capturing our stories. So, and the other thing was in the last documentary, there's this really interesting conversation that emerged around people hating wearing dresses, to the point where at one point I was like, should we change the name of this film? And at the time I was like, no, let me stay true to what The Glorious Ones was about. And I just left Some Girls Hate Dresses kind of hanging there. And then spring forward a year later, a fund came up and I applied for it with this idea of capturing the stories of these women that were born or lived through a pre-social media, pre-internet generation. And let's capture this idea around what was it like at that time. Obviously, I'm part of that story. And it's obviously the focus was on this idea that back then you were a boy, you were a girl, or you were a tomboy. That was kind of the language the people used to describe. And if you liked playing football or climbing trees, as opposed to playing with dolls and, you know, fancy dress, then you weren't a girl, you were a tomboy. And I think as language has changed and evolved as well over time, I just wanted to capture that snapshot. So that's kind of where Some Girls Hate Dresses came from. And then, the summary, it's essentially, it's a story of the tomboys from the Black British experience. You know, I grew up at a time when the images that we did get were a very American, African-American content. It wasn't a Black British experience as such. So I wanted to also capture that. So I've said a lot, but that's kind of where the story came from.
No, not at all. We appreciate it because it's often that we, on this podcast as well, we talk about, especially us from Britain, taking influence from American Black culture and not really having that much of our own. So I think it's really brilliant that you're able to tell this experience from that point of view. And which, you know, funny enough for me, I was explaining to Connie that totally related to like this intersection of like, well, I don't only just play with Barbies. I actually like playing with this and playing football with the lads and all of this stuff. And you didn't really, tomboy was thrown around quite a bit. Apologies now, full disclaimer, if that offends anybody. But that was a term, used very much in the 90s, I would say. And I think it is quite important that you're able to tell this story, especially with these this amazing cast as well, like the contributors that you got to discuss their experience. Before we even get more into the wonderful documentary, where can the viewers go and watch it?
So you can see it on, so it was commissioned by the Iris Prize Documentary Film Fund. I was awarded for that. And that was commissioned by Aberystwyth University and then funded by ITV. which is a North American broadcaster. Mm-hmm. So in the UK, it's called Fruit TV, F-R-O-O-T, Fruit TV. You can find it on my LinkedIn at Mina Fombo. I'm sure we can add links again with this, with the podcast, but also, around the world, you can find it on Out TV.
I was already sold when I saw that it was a nostalgic look at the 90s, which I think as well as Black women, that part of our story is not really told often. So I thought that was really cool as well. So I have extremes. So 1 minute I can be super girly and then next minute I can be a little bit tomboyish. I love my oversized clothing, playing football with the boys, as I was saying, getting cuts and grazes, which my mum completely hated and was furious at most of the time. As I got older, I started experimenting more with my hair by shaving the sides off, colouring it crazy colours, as my mum would say, blue, purples and all of that good stuff. I'll insert the hair pictures. I realised in the 90s, so I feel like you having that gave you some sort of like stereotype as well. Like when I would have my coloured hair, people would have a perception of me, or shave my hair, people would have a perception of me. Did you ever do anything with your style or play a sport that your parents didn't want you to do or didn't feel that you should do?
I feel like it's interesting. I grew up with five older brothers. My sister is the oldest. Oh, wow. There's five boys above me, then I'm the youngest. And so like, for me, like I was quite happy to have my brothers hand-me-downs. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, in that culture. I don't know if people still do that these days because clothes are much cheaper now than back in the day you'd get hand-me-downs. I'd happily wear like an oversized, you know, t-shirt that one of my brothers had or oversized Bermuda shorts. Do you know what I mean? 80s, 90s, all that fashion, shell suits. Do you know what I mean? All that kind of, you know, old school gear from that time. And that's kind of what I wore. And I think for me, I just remember a very distinct shift from primary school age. So up to the age of sort of up to the age of 11. And then you go to secondary school or high school from the age of 11 up to sort of 16. And I remember this shift where primary school, I wore what clothes that would make me stereotypically, not stereotypically, but people would identify with a tomboy. So I wore more boys' clothes, or I preferred boys' clothes, obviously hated wearing skirts, dresses, anything like that. You know, shorts, tracksuit bottoms, trousers. And again, things that by today's standards might not be a big deal, but back then it was the anomaly. Like all the girls wore dresses in my school. So, but going to secondary school, the uniform meant that girls, you had to kind of wear, you know, certain girls' clothes, or PE, you had to wear a netball skirt for PE, whereas in primary school, you could just wear shorts. So I remember for me, it wasn't so much that my family didn't let me wear what I wanted. It was more that it was like, oh, she's a tomboy, you know? Oh, it's almost like the justification as to why she looks like that. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh yeah, she's a tomboy. And people go, oh yeah, of course she is. But then you get to secondary school, you can't really get away with it as much. It's almost like, you know, we talk about this in the film, but like, you know, you go through puberty and your body starts to change and, you know, you kind of have to start to wear things that are much more associated with girls' clothes. And so that was more, so for me, it's more a cultural expectation that I felt the pressure of, and then a uniform that made me have to change my style a little bit. It wasn't, my family didn't really, my family didn't really worry so much. Like my mum would try to like make me wear certain things, but like she knew I hated it. But obviously a formal gathering or event, I'd obviously have to, like a wedding or whatever. But outside of that, she just used to just let me get on with it, because I think she just thought she'll grow out of it.
When did you feel like the pressure came off to kind of rise to those expectations?
You know what? It came for me, I definitely went through... and again, the film is great to, in terms of as a director, but also as a storyteller, it was very like a really healing sort of journey going through, talking to the contributors and hearing all of their stories. And why I want to showcase it is because you kind of feel like you're living in isolation. So I've talked a lot about pre-social media, pre-internet. Your world was very small back in the 80s, 90s. You knew your school, people on your street, maybe some extended family. So you didn't know that someone in the same city or the other side of the city was going through what you were going through, so you feel like it's just you that's going through this experience. So for me, like, you kind of then think, okay, yeah, it is just me wanting to wear trousers. I probably should, you know, try to do makeup. You know, I went through a phase of doing nails and like obviously tried makeup and all of those things. Yeah. And then it wasn't until I got to, I went for a phase of wearing heels when you used to go out, which I always hated. I always rejected it, but that's what you wore if you went out. Yeah. I did. Mm-hmm. And then for me, it's playing rugby. I started playing rugby when I was in my early 20s. Mm-hmm. I remember finishing the game and everyone was getting ready to go out and people were just wearing you had to wear a shirt after the uniform after rugby was a shirt, a tie, which wasn't traditionally what women wore. And then you just go out wearing trainers. And I was just like, oh my God, these are my people.
you found your tribe.
You literally go out in jeans and trainers.
Yeah.
And again, for people that weren't around at that time, that sort of pre-noughties, there are so many places you couldn't go if you were wearing trainers. It'd be you'd get turned away from the club or you get turned away from bars because you were wearing trainers. Whereas obviously trainers now is a massive multi-billion pound industry. But in the 80s, 90s, it was growing and it wasn't something you'd wear. You wouldn't wear a 500 pound pair of trainers out because you still wouldn't get into the club. Whereas now it's trainers have a different place in our society. So I really hope that some girls hate dresses when people see it, especially people that were around at that time and then people that weren't around at that time, just to really understand the real nuance of how brave the contributors were to kind of go against the grain and, be like, I'm going to shave my hair. And what that meant at that time, because it was an act of rebellion, essentially.
Mm. Which I adore, here for it. And I think also, I always say, growing up in the 90s made you so much, I don't know, there's a strength because there's a lot that we had to go through, you went through in the 90s or whenever as a millennial. And that I think so much has changed. And even listening to your wonderful contributors speak about the label Tomboy, and it didn't occur to me that anyone would be insulted or would even find it offensive, because when I saw Tomboys, I thought they were super cool. My big sister was a super tomboy, and so I followed her in everything that she did, and that's who I wanted to aspire to be. So it didn't occur to me that, anyone would find it offensive or would see it in a negative way. I always thought it was super cool. How did you feel about the label Tomboy?
It's a funny one, because there's part retrospective thinking and then there's your thinking at that time. I think at that time I was happy to be a tomboy because I didn't want to be a girl. I didn't want to be associated with what the girls in my school did. I wasn't really into skipping or playing hopscotch. Do you know what I mean? I wasn't I wasn't into that. I was into WWF wrestling. Do you know what I mean? And WCW wrestling and pretending to be Sting or Hulk Hogan, or, I was into football. I played with cars, not dolls. Mm. Do you know what I mean? We built tree houses. I was that type of girl. I wasn't into, brushing hair in the playground or whatever. So I think for me, the label, I didn't see it as a negative label. It was just accepted. But I think as you get older and you look back, you think, God, it's so toxic to think that, it's not that you labeled yourself a tomboy, it's predominantly adults around you labeled you a tomboy. And actually, I wasn't trying to be different. I just was doing things that I enjoyed doing. And I think what comes through in the film, again, with the contributors, is everybody talks about the fact that they were just, they knew who they were, I guess. Mm. And society around you is what makes you then question whether or not you are okay to be yourself. And people, as people watch the film, you'll hear the journeys that people go on and what those conclusions are. And I'm not going to give them away. But for me personally, I think, retrospectively, I'm just I don't feel negatively towards the word. Yeah. And I didn't at the time. It's more thinking about it as an adult, thinking, God, it's so... Why do we label, young people? Why do we need to label? Yeah. Why can't you just, And again, in a world where, like I said, in my school, I was the only girl that played football. Do you know what I mean? Mm. It was me and all the boys playing football and no one else played. And now, obviously, football is a career for women. Do you know what I mean? And you can make it, have a career from it. It's an aspiration. Back when I was younger, it wasn't a career. So it was such a freak thing that I was doing. But I was just I'm just playing football because I like it, whatever.
and that's what I love as well, is that as kids, you're just being yourselves. And it's because we don't, adults have an ideology, and if you don't fit within the ideology, then they just find a label and label you. And then as kids, you kind of just grow with that and think it's normal until you grow up and you're like, actually, maybe I don't want to be labeled that, or I'm uncomfortable with X. So I quite like how your contributors were able to, you know, express that and articulate that as well.
Yeah, and I think there's something to be said for, you know, you know, 20-year-old Mina would have a different perspective than 30-year-old Mina and me now, and so on. And I think there's something to be said around, you realise as you go through life that people like to judge based on their own expectations or limitations. Mm. And so I can appreciate that, like, my Nigerian, you know, mum is, like, trying to make you be how society wants you to be so that you'll succeed in life. And maybe there's a fear that comes with your child not fitting in. Mm. And also as a Black woman, knowing the other layers that you're going to have to go through throughout life and trying to protect your child from that. And then I'm sure, you know, I'm sure other parents of other demographics have their own reasons as well, like similar reasons. And so I can appreciate why, like, as a parent, they'd be like, oh, no, I don't want my child to sort of do this or do that or feel a certain type of way or be a bit wary of it. But then I think the opposite of that, and I'm not a parent, but, like, I would say to parents is that, like, it's not to underestimate the mind of a child. Do you know what I mean? And not to estimate the resilience of an individual. And whilst that fear might be projected from them, that child or that person may be a stronger person or maybe more comfortable to come through whatever other challenges life might throw at them for being different, whether that's a tomboy or being, you know, whatever that might be today, or just being different in general for another reason. And I think there's something about that needs to be said about that.
Absolutely. It's their insecurities and also being worried that they don't want to make life hard for you when they look and reflect on themselves of what was difficult. So they're like, we want to make life as easy as possible for our children, I would think. So this is the easier path that I think will work for them. And so it's always interesting. Do you have a lot of the documentary, Some Girls Hate Dresses, is based about your contributors' childhood, primary, especially its primary school years and secondary school years? Do you have a fond memory of primary school that you feel shaped who you are?
A fond moment. I don't know. The first thing that came to my mind, I don't know if it shaped who I am, but I'd say that it is like, it's a really good representative of that time. And for me, it was the Royal Rumble. And again, if you watched, you watched WWF wrestling back in the day, like and anyone that doesn't watch wrestling, obviously, like, you have all these different wrestlers. And first of all, you have this big argument with your parents continually whether wrestling's fake or not, and you believe that it's real because it is real. And so that's the 100%. Thing. We used to reenact these Royal Rumbles at school, and, like, you'd be sort of stood on the side and you get announced, and you'd come in, and just basically you're having a massive fight within one of the netball squares. And that was obviously the gates. And so I was always a bigger person at school. And for me, like, yeah, like, I'd come in and I'd, like, dominate the Royal Rumble. Because, you know, I was a bigger girl. I was known as the hardest girl in the school. We had that back then. And that was, like, a place where I could shine. And it sounds terrible because I'm talking about not real violence, like play violence, because it's a game.
Yeah.
But, like, to be a girl and everything that a girl is meant to, you know, symbolize, but to then be the strongest person in the school was kind of like, and what? You know what I mean? So it was kind of like I'd come into the Royal Rumble, that I'd have my, like, tag team, and you'd go and, like, have it, you know, put somebody in, like, a headlock or whatever we were doing in a safe way. But I can't even believe they used to let us play that game at school. Like, when
there's
you look
a lot
back
of games that we were allowed to get away with that, honestly, would not happen now.
Yeah, I don't think you could do Royal Rumbles or sleeper holds, practice sleeper holds.
Honestly, but, I actually remember that. I remember the amount of injuries people would get as well. Like, be bloody coming back from break, like, fully. And everyone would be cool with it. It's fine.
But it was, but it was character building. And, so I think for me, like, that stands out as a moment because I think, I don't know, it kind of just sets you up. It doesn't, you know, for me, like I said, you're meant to be, like, the weaker sex or you're the girl, whatever. But because I had that space. And I think my sort of career has been in a similar vein, which is, do you know what, whatever, you can't pigeonhole me, and whatever I'm expected to be, I'm probably going to supersede that and just own what I can bring to any space. And that's okay.
Absolutely. You have an excellent cast. Your contributors are amazing. How did you go about selecting them for Some Girls Hate Dresses?
So it was just a real process. I did a big call out, again, social media is our friend for the most part. We know that there's got the bad side of social media, but it was really great to just connect, do you know what I mean, across the country. And I originally interviewed sort of 15 people in terms of creative process, just on Zoom, and just kind of people came forward, obviously put themselves forward from the ad, and then just started sharing their stories. And so just had really great conversations just to kind of fill the picture of what life was like. And then I guess as a creative process, it was about thinking, okay, whose stories, you know, everyone's stories are amazing, and like everyone's lives are so completely different in different parts of the country, but at the same time, they're all the same, which is really interesting. And so it was kind of just trying to, you're almost like, you know, you're putting together the pieces of a puzzle, and it's like whose story is going to complement who, and what are the different characters, and what are the different journeys that we've gone on. And almost the idea was kind of to try to find, I guess, you know, a really strong narrative through a group of people. So that's kind of how we piece them together. So that's, and then I narrowed that 15 down to those five. One of the things that really stood out really strongly for those five was just this, it came through from the others as well, but this five really made it work, was this passion for sport. And I've mentioned before about how, you know, playing sport, again, all the contributors talk a lot about sport. And I think what I really wanted to try and capture within the film, and just within that time for people, again, who weren't there or to reflect back, was that sport was a way for tomboys to shine. So building on this WWF Royal Rumble, it was like my physicality was a strength in that game, and that was what made me great at that game. And I think, you know, a lot of the, you know, top people that came forward as tomboys or were tomboys were great athletes, do you know what I mean? And at that time, it's different now because sport evolves and more women do sport than ever before and so on. But like, you know, I'll see people playing sport now and people have got their nails done and eyelashes and hair, which is a great look. Like if I'm going out, I'm going to do that. But back in the day, like you could go and play in the sport for women, I think was a place where there wasn't an expectation or necessarily the desire to want to get your nails done and have your hair done and put your makeup on to run around a field and get muddy. So I think sport had a really safe space for either queer or questioning or tomboys or anybody in that spectrum to kind of just go and be away from this idea that you've got to look pretty all the time. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that sport now represents a diversity of women where you've got people that are just rocking up in their as their authentic self, whether that is wearing nails or not wearing nails. It's a space for so many more women and non-binary, you know, people to go into. But back then it was like a safe space. You could just go and wear shorts and not have your hair done and play. And that really, I think, enabled people to come into their own without looking pretty all the time.
Which I think is really important.
And so I think that commonality between their stories was another reason how I got these contributors together, because it was a really, it was a significant part, I think, of the tomboy's journey.
Yeah, definitely. A part of some of your contributors speak about bullying, being bullied at school, and struggling with their identity. Did you ever experience any of that, or struggling with your identity as well?
I think for me, it wasn't so much that I struggled with my identity. I felt very confident in who I was. It was more the fact that I knew that I couldn't do the things that I wanted to do because it wasn't culturally acceptable. So I very distinctly remember going to secondary school, and in my primary school, like everyone knew me. I played with all the boys. The boys were my friends. It was normal. I played football, whatever, do all that. That was my idea. I went to a different school out of town compared to my friends. So when I got there, those boys didn't know me. And I can remember walking into the class on the first day of year 7 and it was like two tables with all the boys sat, and then there's like two tables where all the girls were sat. Yeah. Like, I remember standing there, and I went to walk to the boys' table, and they all sort of looked at me like, "What are you doing?" kind of thing. I remember thinking, and then I just kind of turned and I went and sat on the girls' table because I felt that's where I should sit. And then, and it was a massive thing because that's where I sat for the next 5 years of secondary school, was on the girls' table. And I, and that was where my, like, the relationship that I had with my male or boyfriends at school, I didn't have that then until adulthood, because that's, everyone is very split. PE gets split into girls versus and boys, they're separate. And I get, and now I understand why that can happen and you can excel. But for me, I was so used to it. So I had to learn how to be a girl. I had to learn how to assimilate into what girls did. So the boys were playing football at break, and like me and my friends were like in the toilets and the girls were doing their hair. And I was just like bored, like, I'll just write on the walls. Do you know what I mean? Because I wasn't doing my hair or makeup. Like, my hair is in Cambridge. Like, I went to a white school.
Yeah.
So that was, it wasn't so much, I don't know if that was about, maybe that is about identity, but it was just, I knew what I liked, but I just knew that that wasn't acceptable. So I thought, well, let me just try to grow up, be a girl, hang out with girls. But I also remember being bored.
Yeah. And you just said that you were at an all white school. Were you the only black person at your school? Was there not that
many?
Like,
I think in my year, I was the only black girl in my year. There's a mixed race boy. And then like in the whole school, throughout the whole 5 years I was there, there's probably maybe six students of color, maybe seven. It wasn't very many of us.
Because I feel like even that experience will affect your time at secondary school in terms of having people to relate to. And, you know, things like doing your hair in the toilets. Most of my time in secondary school and primary school, my hair were in extensions or cane rows or whatever. So you're not doing your hair in the toilets because it's already done in the morning.
Yeah.
And, you know, things like that. And I think someone from the same background would totally understand that. So we're in and out of the loo. No time to dilly-dally. And so I just can only imagine, even myself, I don't think there was that many, but it was, we still had a few in primary school. And yeah, so it can really affect how you relate to people, and you know, especially when you see another culture and how, what they do as well, and what they seem as normal as well, and you're like, okay, maybe that's what I need to be doing to kind of fit in and be girly or whatever it might be, even though you don't understand it, but you're just like, okay, cool. Because my school was predominantly Asian, and then it was probably black, and then white, or a mixture of everything else. But yeah, so it was quite interesting to see that.
I think what I really wanted to capture as well was like this idea of the black experience outside of London. So, you know, the contributors, I think one of the contributors is from like outskirts of London, but everybody else is from Wales, Manchester, you know, Gloucester, about like outside. And like there's this like, you know, through my work that I do with Black Girl Convention, I run a lot of events, I run a lot of retreats for Black women, non-binary. And so for me, it was like, okay, the narratives that we didn't have many narratives in our time. And then the narratives that we do have started to focus on a London-centric experience. And again, with the accessibility of being able to create your own content has been amazing. Like I remember watching from like 2006-07 this explosion of like the black female experience, like on, you know, just be like, this is amazing, like this is great, and like how amazing is it for generations to just have this? Because if you lived in an area where you were the only black person in your school, you didn't have access to that. And all you got was the five TV channels. So there's so much more sort of, you know, diversity within our own people that young people today, for example, can be have access to. So for me, but I wanted to capture the stories of the people that didn't have that. Again, pre-social media, outside London, what is it like to be the black person growing up in Wales? Do you know what I mean? What is it like to be the black person growing up on the outskirts of Manchester in the 1980s? And again, what's really fascinating is, despite the fact that the contributors are all so far apart in different parts of the country, different heritage in terms of cultural heritage, but a very similar narrative in terms of an experience. And so I wanted to add that other layer onto it as well and capture that. And I think Some Girls Hate Dresses does that beautifully.
Absolutely. Because like I was saying, you know, mine was just outside London. But yeah, again, just hearing their stories, which are all relatable, was really nice to kind of see as well. I have so many favourite lines in the documentary. Do you have a favourite line before I say a few of mine?
There is a favourite line, but I'm not going to say it because it's in the opening, so I'm not going to say that one.
Okay, it's probably the same one that I was thinking of, so I won't say that one either.
I won't spoil that one. That's a great, but it's in the opening scene. It's really powerful. Yep. And that's love just it. David on the day we filmed it, I was like, oh wow, like this is so deep. But favorite lines, oh yeah, I'll have to come back to you. Favorite line, there's the thing is, for me, like, it's almost like I forget what's in the actual film because everybody's interviews were like an hour that I'd interview for an hour. Oh. And like when you they always say that it's like, I was talking to an old mentor of mine actually, and she once said to me, like, sometimes the art of storytelling can take away from storytelling. And so when you have so much you believe to be rich content that the world needs to hear, and then you have to shave all of that down into a 25 minute film, you feel like you're losing so much context and like richness. And the art of, I guess, directing and the edit is to not allow your audience to feel that, they've had a whole story told. And I think that we do that, but from a creative perspective behind the scenes, I'm like, but we lost so many other amazing scenes. So the great lines I'm thinking of, so I don't even know, so many things that were said, I'm like, oh, was that in the film in the end or was it not? Because you're cutting.
Yeah, of course. You're in edit producer mode at the moment. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. I won't say the main one that's at the beginning, but like one of them was, your contributor said, being black and gay wasn't easy. And I just was like, that's such a strong statement to say. And you, especially for everybody else, might not think about that, those two experiences, you know, being black is hard as it is. And then being black and gay is, can be, you know, they can find it double hard. So even that statement I love a documentary that has me like questioning things and thinking about that person and putting myself in that person's shoes, which I feel like Some Girls Hate Dresses does very well.
Even for me, like talking to people, what was interesting is like, you know, because language changes so much. And so some people refer to themselves as gay. Obviously some people say queer. Right. Some people say, some people just say they're just who they are. And I think there's so much more space for self-defined, non-defined use of language today, which just makes for much more richer conversations and allows people to be their authentic self. And I think even just, talking to people and hearing their stories then, it was like, oh, that's interesting. That's how you refer to yourself. Like, I wonder, I wonder which generation, do the generations still say that now? And is that, do people relate to that or not? And I find that even that in itself was an interesting conversation we had. I think also what I really loved about the way we did the film in terms of just creative process was like, you know, for me, like, you know, as a filmmaker, I have Black Wave Productions. So that's a production studio that I co-founded with my business partner, Michael Jenkins. And from the offset, you know, we always wanted to obviously create a studio and or a company, I should say, and then have our sets be these diverse, inclusive spaces and represent obviously our community. And so just kind of, you know, I had somebody on set and that, like, as a runner, and they were just sort of like, do you know what? I've never been on a set where so many people, so many women refer to their wife, and just being in an environment, being around people that say that, I was like, wow, this is what adulthood could look like. You know, I've not been in an environment where I've met so many people that have a wife and who are also female. Mm. So I was like, oh, great. Like, and, you know, we made our set for the day was obviously we had the food, you know, music, just kind of like everyone was invited for the whole day. So just the contributors connecting with each other was something that I wanted to create off set. And then you think, oh, I should have captured that as well. But you know what it's like.
And that's beautiful as well, especially for that runner, because, you know, working in production, I know exactly how influential that image will be to them. Because I remember when I was coming into the industry and I was just like, you know, you pick up certain things or you're exposed to certain things and you're like, wow, that's really cool. And if I wasn't in the industry, I don't think I would have been exposed to certain things that which kind of open up your mind and understanding. So I think that's really awesome. So just a few questions about your awesome self. You are a winner of the first Iris Prize Documentary Film Fund. How did you feel about winning that?
It was, yeah, it's an achievement, right? It's kind of like I said, I'm quite driven. And so if I'm focused, I was like, you know what? I'm going to put in for this fund and I'm going to get it. And I'm going to make sure that I feel like what's required to win it. And for me, it was about, yeah, I felt like I had a great idea, a great story. And yeah, just demonstrated that I could make it. And so, and going through all those phases, it was like an 8-month process. The Iris, depending on when you hear this, but it's live again. So there's another round of it happening. There was a round last year as well. But yeah, it was just great to be able to get that, next step. You know, I think as a production company, as Black Wave Productions, we do stuff for obviously broadcast, BBC, Channel 4, BET. And then we also do stuff for British Film Institute and independent film as well. I think for me, the beauty of the fund was that it was a story that I was really passionate about telling. And, you know, we had the creative control over who were the final contributors.
Yeah. Also, you're a global speaker with a brilliant TED Talk, No, You Cannot Touch My Hair. What inspired you to tell this story? Even though I don't feel I need an explanation because I too have experienced this, and I think probably most of the Black women in the world have, but tell us why you wanted to make this documentary.
I think for Same Girl, Same Dresses, like I said, for me, it's about representation, and my body of work speaks to that. And I think for me also, it is recognizing that there are definitely key points in my career where I didn't have a voice, or I didn't have sort of power or influence, or the experience to navigate playing the game or not playing the game or holding people to account because of, you know, all the isms, institutional racism, sexism, do you mean all of the isms? And so I'd always kind of committed to myself that my goal was to put myself in a position of power and influence to understand the systems around me, and then to share that knowledge. And that kind of represented in my work as a consultant, in the equity space, and also in as a storytelling space, and then also in the space where I run events. And so for me, this story is just an extension of my portfolio of work, where I feel like, you know, we have been done a disservice in capturing the stories of Black women, capturing the stories of the LGBTQ community, capturing the stories of an intergenerational demographic of Black women, because we didn't have access to, or were denied access in 60s, 70s, 80s. If you try to, you know, go and get archive of, in fact, one of my films that I made, Home Carnival Queen, which was for BBC Arts a few years back, I was trying to find some archive, and it was filmed in Nigeria of people dancing. It was filmed, I'm not sure who it was filmed by, but the point is that archive isn't owned by the Black community. It's not owned by a Black archive studio. It's owned by Pathé in France. And it's great that they gave me the rights to it, but it cost a lot of money for 30 seconds, almost, you know, a large percentage of the budget. And it's like, because we didn't have access to cameras, kit, film, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. All of this, that stuff back then, we don't own any of our, we own our verbal histories. And we obviously have our own archives and photos and other content, but in terms of the broadcast content, those stories were told predominantly through a white gaze, and then we don't own that content either. And so bring that forward to the TV shows that were made, the drama, the docs that were made in the 70s, 80s, 90s, again, all of that content that we see wasn't predominantly made by us. And then on top of that, we have this American influence, which I loved American shows, but again, it wasn't our stories. And so I really feel passionately about going back in time and recreating these stories. And in fact, Some Girls Hate Dresses, we did originally have like an 8-minute drama that was going to weave through the contributor stories, and we kind of sort of capture this essence of this narrative that runs through, which you'll see when you watch the film. But that script was is just because of delivery timescales and so on, we just had to, and casting and so on, we had to just really think, okay, maybe we just need to car park that and make the film for what it is currently, and maybe we'll tell that story further down the line. So that's what I'm driven by, is you know, filling in the blanks almost.
So now to see us in positions where we can tell our own stories from our own experiences, I'm championing it as much as I can because I love it. Love to see it. So moving on to the quick fire round, just a few quick questions. Do you have a favourite comedian, actor or just stand-up?
Oh, favourite comedian, actor or stand-up. Okay. Oh my God. She is... Jesus. Tiffany Haddish.
Oh, Tiffany,
yeah. I've always been a fan of Tiffany from way back when. I love. Oh my God, Jesus. British writer, comedian, Nigerian, lives in LA. Gina, that's it. Yeah, Gina Yashore. I remember watching her. God, what is wrong with my brain today? Let me say that.
I'm so glad I was on it, though. I'm so glad.
love Gina Yashore from way back in the day. Like, I remember just going to lots of stand-ups in the UK, and like, I just love the way that her career has played out as well.
Very happy for her.
Definitely. I used to love Lady Jocelyn, actually. Miss Jocelyn was funny, but you know, there are so many today.
I'm such a great fan of Miss Jocelyn. Like, she had me crying with tears of just laughter, because she's just absolutely hilarious. And I need to come back and just do more, really. Need her on the screens, definitely. There's a great name.
Just for more content, socials content, there's so many again on socials that you're just watching, but I really love Elaine baby her socials, Elaine Stay in My she's hilarious. Like, anytime she drops anything, I'm like, I'm on that.
Do you have a favorite Black director or writer?
Obviously, Ava DuVernay is a legend in the game. Just love all of her work. I'm going to go way back in the day and talk about Love and Basketball. When that film dropped, I can't remember the what's her name.
Gina
Prince Bythewood.
Yes.
Something's wrong with me today. Prince Bythewood. I just loved her. And I love the fact that she then came to direct The Woman King. Do you know what I mean? And like, again, for me, it's an example of, you know, I was studying film back in the early noughties. And I remember when Love and Basketball came out, I was like, who is this woman? Like, it was such, because it's sport, she's a tomboy. Like, do you know what I mean? All the links are kind of there. Everything was, it was perfect. But then obviously the opportunities come few and far between for Black female directors. So she's stayed in the game. So to then come and be able to make The Woman King, do you know what I mean? Absolutely. With obviously Viola Davis, do you know what I mean? And it was just, for me, I was like, yes, like get your take. I hope that they continue to give her flowers, because, she's a brilliant storyteller.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that answer. And do you have an all-time favourite Black-led movie?
Do I have an all-time favourite? That's hard. It's difficult, because there's lots for different reasons. I've obviously mentioned Love and Basketball, because that was, to me, it's just there's like classics. That's one of my classics. I really love Spike Lee's School Days. From back in the day, again, classic. Waiting to Exhale was a game changer. I'm thinking in my 90s head, because these were movies at the time that really impacted me. Do you know what I mean? Like, and absolutely. I feel like Waiting to Exhale was great, because Angela Bassett in that scene where she just burns that. From I was a drama student, so that was a monologue. There weren't many monologues a Black woman actor. Whereas when I saw that, I was like, right, that's going to be my monologue. Like, these were stories that really impacted me. So I'm kind of nostalgic in that sense. I love a musical of any kind. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'll take that. And then more recently, can't think, my mind. Serafina, classic movie, again.
Yeah.
Like the original, those type of movies for me.
Yeah, I'm the same. Like, I can remember. Yeah, I can remember films and music clearly from the 90s. But ask me what like dropped 10 years ago, I'll be like, I don't know.
I don't even know what I watched last night. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, what? I watch a lot more. You watch a lot more series, you know?
Yes, you get to, exactly.
I want more. I'm like, just give me more. Feed me like more, more, more. I watch a lot more series.
It merges into one after the 90s. I kind of feel like things just merged into one.
I'll tell you what I watched recently and I thought it was absolutely beautiful was Earth Mama. And I thought that was such a beautiful, brilliant film. I love the fact that she kind of like has used this, it's almost like you could see that obviously the interviews, do you know what I mean? With the real contributor that then were weaved into this narrative. And I really love the idea of, again, I tried to do it a little bit with Some Girls Take Dresses, but I'm really interested in the genre of this hybrid docudrama feel sort of format. You could feel those stories through those contributors who were their real story, you know, like with this story. Yeah, so I thought that was a beautifully told, intimate, challenging, important story.
Very, very much so. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed talking to the director as well. That was very, very cool. And it's just nice to see these different multifaceted stories of Black women told as well, rather than just this one dimensional. And that's why we have to keep, you know, giving people like yourself, Mina, their flowers for being able to produce amazing content like this. I just want to say a huge thank you for your time. I know you're a busy, busy person, for sharing your time with us. And again, you guys know where to go and watch the documentary Some Girls Hate Dresses. So just want to appreciate you and thank you again for coming onto the Black Ink Cinema podcast and wish you all the best.
Thank you so much. It's been great. Have a good one.